So good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Great to see you all here this morning. Some new people and some visitors from afar and some regulars and some irregulars. And you're all part of the extended Sangha. So I had two Dharma talks mind for today, and they're and I'm postponing both of them. The first one I had in mind was about some of the what are called tend to be called folk religious practices that we encountered in Japan, both a long time ago when Michael and I lived there, and then in our recent Sangha trip in May. It's easy to for Westerners to look at what we folk practices as quaint or and be even a little dismissive or pejorative about them from the standpoint of our materialistic culture. And yet many of us on the recent trip, except for us, were people who had never even been to Japan, were intrigued by and often deeply moved by some of these practices. So I wanted to talk about that and look into what those practices can mean and see if there's something perhaps that we leave out in our very approach to our practice. But I also wanted to do it with a little slideshow. And so you're going to have to wait for that, because it's going to take me a little while to assemble. Especially given that this past week or so, Michael and I have acquired two new laptops, and it's taken some time to get everything transferred and get them up and running. Because so much time has changed in the 6.5 years since we last bought laptops. It's a little hard for me not to feel resentful of the juggernaut of technological change that grinds me beneath its wheels. Sometimes it feels. You know the word juggernaut? We use it to represent a kind of literal or metaphorical force regarded as mercilessly destructive and unstoppable. But does anyone know the origin of the word? Oh, okay. So it's derived, excuse me, from the Sanskrit Jagannatha, which means world lord, and it was one of the names of Krishna, found in the Sanskrit epics. So what's the connection? So the Jagannath Temple in Puri, state of Odisha in India, holds an annual procession of huge decorated wagons carrying statues of Jagannath, Krishna, and Hindu deities. This is Wikipedia. The first English description of this procession is in the 14th century, and it describes devotees flinging themselves to their deaths beneath the wheels of these great carts, although apparently later accounts attributed to the deaths to the great crush of the crowds and people falling beneath the wheels. So the word juggernaut comes into English usage in the 17th century, referring to the huge wagons themselves as objects of blind devotion. You know, so there's a little bit of a pejorative tinge there. And then by extension, the metaphorical meaning of an inexorable force grinding all beneath it. So, I'm overstating the case against technological change by using the word juggernaut. And it certainly doesn't apply to technological change per se. But what gets under my skin about this particular brand of technological change is that so much of it is motivated not by any real concern for human health or well-being, but by the need to keep us buying more devices, you know, to power economic growth. And it gets under my skin because of the huge quantities of toxic waste being produced by our devices, our cast-off electronic devices, obsolete in 3 to 6 years or less. And this waste is shipped to China and picked over by unprotected children salvaging the recyclable materials. So that's what gets under my skin. And I do feel helpless to speak back to Microsoft and say, did we really need Windows 10? I don't want to be a blind devotee. But I digress. Or maybe not. The second Dharma talk I planned for today, the one that I actually started, was inspired by my reading of a book by the social critic Barbara Ehrenreich called Living with a Wild God. How many people know her work? Yeah, not that many. I'll talk more about that when I get to that talk. But she was very well known, you know, more in the 70s and 80s. But she's still very prolific and very smart. And if there was ever a rational materialist atheist, it would be her. This book she wrote after a bout of breast cancer, and having gone back and read her journals in her teens about spontaneous mystical experiences she had then, which she never spoke about to anybody, and trying to somehow integrate those experiences with the course of her adult life. So I was struck as I read the book by some parallels and some differences between her adolescent experience and subsequent life path and my own. You know how some books become a kind of extended dialogue between yourself and the author? Well, this one was very much so for me. And so I thought, I want to write her a letter. I want to write her a letter. And so I started the Dharma talk as an open letter to Barbara Ehrenreich. And then Thursday night I got a call to go to work. I work on call, sometimes as a counselor at a women's clinic, and one of the counselors was really sick, so I went. And I took the new laptop and I did some work on the talk on the West Coast Express as I went in. And then on the way home, I took out the laptop, put it on my lap, put the book beside me on the seat, looked at the Georgia Strait for a little bit, and fell asleep. When it came to my stop, I packed everything up. And it wasn't until Saturday morning that I realized I had left the book on the West Coast Express. What to do? I could throw the first talk together, but I really wanted to take the time to present this one and get the slideshow together. So I decided not to. And I needed my quotes from her book, so I couldn't do that. I thought, well, I could resurrect some old talk. And then I remember doing a talk a long time ago that I gave the title, Faith in What? And I thought, this question of what is faith? What is faith without a God, without a supreme being or a deity? Which is kind of what she addresses in the book. What is faith in terms of our Zen practice? I thought this question kind of links up with the other two talks. So I looked up the old talk to see what I had to say back then, almost 15 years ago. I realized it was probably the second Dharma talk I ever did. It's really old. So here's what I said. I said, I have recently experienced something of a crisis, more of a crisis of confidence than of faith, as I told my teacher, Norman Fisher, and he said, that's good. It's good to have crises of confidence. I suppose if my faith in the Dharma were fully realized, I would not have had a crisis in confidence. However, we do not come to Zen practice fully realized. And if we think we are fully realized, even after many years of practice, we are pretty well guaranteed to be mistaken. It's probably good to have periodic crises of confidence and faith to keep us honest and humble and to refresh our beginner's mind. So I'd like to talk about the role of faith in Zen practice and how it can help us through those times when our confidence, resilience are shaken, when the conditioning of our karmic lives seems so much stronger than our feeble efforts to stop the turning wheel. Faith is not a word or concept that figures often in Zen literature, discourse, or practice. But faith has an important role to play in practice. Faith in what? If Buddhism offers us no creed, nothing that we have to believe in, no supreme being, no solid ground, what do we have faith in? Buddhist teacher Stephen Batchelor wrote a book called The Faith to Doubt. And in that book, he quotes a 17th century Zen master, Japanese Zen master Takasui, who said, "You must doubt deeply again and again. Pay no attention to the various illusory thoughts and ideas that may occur to you. Only doubt more and more deeply, gathering together in yourself all the strength that is in you without aiming at anything or expecting anything in advance, without intending to be enlightened, and without even intending not to be enlightened. Become like a child within our own breast. Like a child within your own breast." So this is not so much a matter of finding some object of faith, but continuously letting go of certainty, letting go of fixed views about the self, others, the world, practicing a wide open attitude of not knowing, questioning, what is this? This, this sound, this body, this self, where did it come from? Where does it go? This is called the great doubt in Zen, the great doubt of not knowing. Not the small doubt, the small doubts, the serious small doubts we have, the fretting doubts about whether we are better or worse or just as good as somebody else or something else. Whether we have the right stuff for the job, for the relationship, for Dharma practice. Niggling doubts, you know, habitual doubts. Those are small doubts. But even small doubts can propel us into great doubt if we look more deeply into the nature of our suffering. Who is this we are so convinced we are? Where do these ideas come from about what we should and should not be? As the old saying goes, great doubt, enlightenment, little doubt, little enlightenment, no doubt, no enlightenment. The Vipassana teacher Sharon Salzberg wrote a warm and encouraging book called Faith, Trusting Your Own Deep Experiences, in which she shares her own experiences with faith and crises of faith. She writes, "No matter what we encounter in life, it is faith that enables us to try again, to trust again, to love again. Even in times of immense suffering, it is faith that enables us to relate to the present moment in such a way that we can go on. We can move forward, instead of becoming lost in resignation or despair. Faith links our present-day experience, whether wonderful or terrible, to the underlying pulse of life. That mysterious underlying pulse of life. Yeah. So we can apply what she's saying here both to our personal fears and discouragement and the kind of collective fear and discouragement that many of us feel in response to what's going on in our world today. You know, when we see almost every day another example of fear and hatred-based violence. So we do need both personal faith and collective faith. The word for faith in the Pali language, the ancient Pali language, is sadha, usually translated as faith, trust, confidence. But it literally means to place the heart upon. So we place the heart upon the vivid present moment over and over again, releasing with each breath into the unknown. Even when our conditioned self is kicking and screaming and hanging on to our suffering, saying, no, I just can't do this. I'm not brave enough. I'm not smart enough. Or we're directing it outward and complaining about what's wrong with everyone else in the world. But if we fully experience each moment, somehow our suffering softens, it shifts, and releases enough for us to keep from doing further harm to ourselves or someone else in our distress. And to go on, you know, to go on, even in our confusion. Within the vastness of our true nature. And sometimes, even in our darkest moments, we crack open. We crack right open of boundlessness to a compassion as wide as the world. Sharon Salzberg calls it as a heart as wide as the world in one of her books. Buddhist teaching identifies three kinds of faith: bright faith, verifying faith, and abiding faith. So bright faith is the honeymoon phase. These are the kinds of faith in our practice lives. So verifying faith in bright faith, we are filled with eagerness and excitement at the prospect of liberation and a practice that can help us on our way. Bright faith gives us the energy and the courage to embark on our practice, away from our conventional security blankets and habit patterns, seeking love, pleasure, success, approval, financial security. It gives us the courage to look closely at suffering and its causes. But in the thrall of bright faith, we might be apt to adore or idealize our teacher in a way that places authority outside ourselves. Bright faith can be intoxicating, can set us up for a crash into discouragement or disappointment. And that crash from the high of bright faith can be hard. A beloved teacher betrays us in a great or small way. We fail to live up to the high standards we set for ourselves. We practice really, really hard, and we feel like we're making progress. And then our old tiresome habit patterns and addictions surge up stronger than ever. Or we have a close encounter with sickness, old age, or death that shakes us to the core. However, bright faith is not the same as blind faith, though it can resemble it. Sharon Salzberg points out that with bright faith, we surrender cynicism and apathy, but not discriminating intelligence. Here's where the second kind of faith, verifying faith, has to kick in. Here's where we get down to the hard work of questioning, of verifying our own experience, by our own experience, the truths of impermanence, suffering, and no separate self. This is what the Buddha insisted we do. He insisted we not believe his teachings just because he said so, but to verify through our own experience. Does this practice open our hearts and minds? Does it help us to see beyond our narrow views? Does it guide our speech and actions with wisdom and compassion? Then we can trust it. Verifying faith can be hard slogging that requires all our patience and persistence when the way gets rough and rocky. But verifying faith can also open into joy at the beauty of human kindness and generosity. Joy in the opening of our heart, mind, and senses to the world around us. When life in this world has put our practice to the test a few times, our faith begins to penetrate our lives to the very marrow. This becomes abiding faith. There's something incontrovertible, something we can't go back on. Even when we still inevitably have further layers of karmic conditioning arise. We have an awareness of our own delusion. We have a compassion for others and ourselves. We have a magnetic compass that brings us back into alignment with our vows, our aspirations. We sit down on our zafu, we get up and live our lives. We take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And with each breath, with each step, we let go and let go and let go into the present moment. That's abiding faith. The Buddha said in the Bhadekarata Sutta, "For the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let one see each presently arisen state. Let one know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made." So this is faith with a Zen sensibility, opening to the unfolding of each moment with fully engaged awareness, entering into great doubt and letting our small doubt propel us there. Better than no doubt at all, right? So I'd like to share a practice with you. And this is still from the old talk, right? that strengthened my faith during that crisis of confidence and others since. Prayer. You may say, prayer? What's a good Zen girl like you doing praying? Well, I wasn't much of a prayer, even in my early Baptist days. I never had that kind of personal relationship with a big daddy God. I have to confess, I've never had much of that bright faith I was talking about earlier. Kind of skimmed over into the verifying and the abiding. So it's good for me actually to revive, you know, to allow some of that bright faith. I don't even remember believing in Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. So what about prayer? I got the idea from a book called The Wisdom of the Dark Emotions by Miriam Greenspan, who's a Vipassana practitioner, a psychotherapist, and also connects to her Jewish heritage. And she suggests a threefold prayer that can be done with or without a supreme being. It goes like this: help me, thank you, I surrender. So my recasting of this as a Dharma prayer goes something like this. You can use your own words and I vary them. Help me. I open to receive the support from the Dharma of sentient and non-sentient beings that is always available all around me in each moment. Thank you. I open to gratitude for everything and everyone that supports my life in each moment. I surrender the self-clinging that only brings suffering and delusion. I open to each moment of my life just as it is. So I don't actually say all those words, but I use those keywords to prompt the direct experience of those of each of those states: receptivity, connection, gratitude, letting go. Maybe that's what prayer is or can be. It's been a surprisingly good antidote to the crises of small doubt that I encounter still on a somewhat regular basis. Our teacher Norman Fisher has called prayer a calling out. Sometimes we need to call out from our fear and despair, to give words and voice to our call, to let small doubt turn to great doubt, and then listen. So that's what I had to say some years ago, facing my doubts about being a Zen priest. And so it's been kind of good for me to look back at that and see that it stands the test of time. And that faith in this very practice of awakening, faith in not knowing, enlivened by a little Dharma prayer when things get rough, is exactly what will help me not stand blindly before the juggernaut, any juggernaut, anything that I feel is bearing down on me in that way, whether it's electronic technology or, you know, the great, or climate change, yeah, the great threats to our lives today. This practice will help me see deeply into the impermanence and contingent nature of that juggernaut, you know, what I'm perceiving as juggernaut, and leap free, to use it, in the case of electronic technology, to use it without being used by it, to use it to write a new Dharma talk or revive an old one, or let it go and pull a Dharma talk out of thin air once in a while. Trusting that there's a bodhisattva riding on every dust mote, just waiting to whisper in my ear. And that, you know, in using various practices like the Dharma prayer I mentioned, it's just a way of inclining or aligning heart and mind, body, heart, and mind, towards our aspirations, towards our bodhisattva vows, and enlivening, brightening the faith to go on. So please stay tuned for the other two Dharma talks. They are coming. And maybe they form a kind of series, actually, I think, that they will be related to this question of faith in our practice. So thank you. Thank you all for listening and coming out to practice together today.